Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the Saturday, March 12th, 2022 reading of the Denver Post. My name is Doug Crane. First, daylight saving time begins tomorrow, Sunday, March 13th. Be sure to turn clocks ahead 1 hour tonight. Today, we will be reading from the following main articles. Cash for grass. State, save water, cut lawns from yards. Legislators consider plan that would pay businesses, homeowners to install climate-friendly landscapes. By Conrad Swanson. The Denver Post. Invasion of Ukraine. Planes, artillery, widen attack. Russia strikes cities far from main battle lines, pressing its plan to bomb its neighbor into submission. By Juris Carmenau, The Associated Press. Charges dropped in 2020 killing. DA, victims threatening actions fueled decision. By Lee Schmelzer, The Denver Post. Most favored nation, U.S. EU G7 / Russian trade status. By Josh Boak, Chris Majerian, and Zeke Miller, The Associated Press. And following up with miscellaneous articles. Cash for grass. State, save water, cut lawns from yards. Legislators consider plan that would pay businesses, homeowners to install climate-friendly landscapes. By Conrad Swanson, The Denver Post. Facing a historic mega drought across the West with no end in sight, Colorado lawmakers looking for easy and effective ways to conserve water set their sights on Kentucky bluegrass. Not just Kentucky bluegrass, but all kinds of non-native grasses planted in front lawns, back lawns, green strips, fronting businesses, and apartment complexes. Those lawns take up about half the water used in Colorado's cities. There's not any more water out there, and what water is out there is becoming really expensive, John Bergren, a water policy analyst with Western Resource Advocates, said. So let's look at how we're using it now. Bergren's organization backs a bipartisan effort at the Capitol to launch a statewide turf replacement program, which would pay homeowners and business owners to replace their non-native ornamental lawns with plants and landscapes better adapted to the state's dry climate. The legislation, House Bill 1151, would be an effective way to manage demand of the state's water, sponsoring State Representative Mark Catlin, Republican of Montrose, said in a late February committee hearing, and the replacement would be entirely voluntary. Rather than telling people you have to, this is an opportunity for people to come in and say, I'd like to, said Catlin, part of the leadership of the House Committee on Agriculture, Livestock, and Water. Similar programs across the West have saved billions of gallons of water, paying property owners from a few dimes to a few dollars for every square foot of turf they replace. These types of programs, offering money for the removal of water-dependent lawns, are likely to become more common as states, counties, and cities across the West search for relatively painless ways to conserve the resource, water experts told the Denver Post. About 19 Colorado cities, utilities, and water districts already have turf replacement programs. The legislation would offer matching dollars for those programs, adding to the rebate property owners would receive. The bill also would help governments launch programs of their own, and people who live in areas without such a program could apply directly to the state for money as well. For too long, the Western Slope and the Eastern Plains have borne the brunt of water conservation, sponsoring State Representative Dylan Roberts, Democrat of Steamboat Springs, said during the February committee meeting. The proposal gives the metropolitan areas the chance to play their fair part, Roberts said. The same old calculus doesn't work anymore. Perhaps the most common reason why grassy lawns are so common throughout Colorado and the West is because people were used to having them, Berggren said. As people move from the east, from places around the Mississippi River, from places with lots of natural rainfall and plenty of water, they brought with them a certain aesthetic desire. They wanted that big bluegrass lawn, Berggren said. They wanted those parks. They wanted those green median strips. It looks good to a lot of folks. For decades, the aesthetic wasn't terribly problematic. The West appeared to have enough water, he said. People could take forever how much they wanted for their lawns. But as time went on, climatologists and water experts began to understand that the Colorado River was over-appropriated. Then in 2002, Berggren said, a mega-drought started, made worse by explosive development. Now in the 21st century, we know water is more limited, he said. The same old calculus doesn't work anymore. Most of those lawns and green strips don't serve a purpose, Zane Marshall, director of resources and facilities for the Southern Nevada Water Authority, said. They're ornamental. Certain green spaces, such as parks and sports fields, are what Marshall calls functional. Turf replacement programs, such as the one in the Las Vegas Valley, focus on non-functional lawns. How much water grasses and plants might require depends heavily on geography and regional climate, Marshall said. But in Las Vegas, a square foot of grass can consume 73 gallons of water every year. Replacing that grass with native plants and landscaping can cut that to 18 gallons or less. Case studies in Las Vegas, Greeley, and Castle Rock. The Las Vegas Valley has always been dry. The desert region averages slightly more than 4 inches of rain a year. The people that live there take 90% of their water from the Colorado River and the rest from an underground aquifer in the area. For generations, water supply wasn't as much of a problem, Marshall said. Most homes built in the past 30 years came with automated irrigation or sprinkler systems for their lawns. But nearing the turn of the century, water became less plentiful, and officials in the valley took notice. The Water Authority launched its Water Smart Landscapes Rebate Program in 1999, Marshall said, offering residents 40 cents for every square foot of lawn they were willing to replace. The program took off. Valley residents, apartment managers, and business owners took the authorities' money and replaced their thirsty bluegrass with sedimentary rocks, Nevada agave, and desert marigolds. The authority upped its rebate to $1 per square foot in 2003, then $2 in 2007. Now the authority offers $3 per square foot up to 10,000 square feet, Marshall said. Then it offers $1.50 per square foot after that. To date, property owners in the Las Vegas Valley have removed more than 200 million square feet of turf, converting it to water-efficient landscaping, Marshall said. That amounts to about 72,000 individual projects. That's enough turf to wrap an 18-inch wide strip of sod around the circumference of the earth, he said. That translates to 11.2 billion gallons of water saved just last year, 163 billion gallons since the program started, Marshall said. In that same time, the valley's population grew by 49%, but the amount of water it takes from the Colorado River shrank by 26%, Bronson Mack, a spokesman for the authority, said. A similar rebate program from Los Angeles Metropolitan Water District was estimated in 2015 to save up to 26 billion gallons of water each year, the Los Angeles Times reported. In Colorado, Greeley's turf replacement program, called Life After Lawn, is younger but still successful, said water conservation manager Dina Eggenhoff. Since launching in 2018, the program has helped property owners replace more than 150,000 square feet of turf, saving an estimated 32 million gallons of water. Not only does the program save water, but it also saves property owners money. And their new native plants thrive much better in Colorado's dry climate, Eggenhoff said. They lower their water bills, and they can still have a beautiful landscape no matter what climate conditions are now or in the future, she said. Castle Rock's turf replacement program has saved millions of gallons, too. According to water efficiency supervisor Rick Schultz, the city has cut residential water use by 7% since starting its replacement program in 2009. Non-residential properties became eligible for the rebates a decade later and have since cut water use by about 29%, he said. Schultz said Castle Rock doesn't dictate how people replace their grassy lawns, but does offer a native plant database full of hundreds of options of grasses, flowers, and shrubs that thrive in the high desert. He calls it Coloradoscaping. We want it to look regionally appropriate, Schultz said, promoting a landscape that fits the look and feel of Colorado's Front Range. Some people go with Russian sage and yuccas, he said. Others go with switchgrass or Mexican feathergrass. Some don't plant anything and instead install decks, fire pits, or artificial turf putting greens, he said. So long as it uses less water, it probably qualifies. Some people get really creative with it, he said. The voluntary nature of the program takes out much of the controversy, Schultz acknowledged, too. Plus, many Coloradans are interested, Eganhoff said. Greeley recently surveyed more than 700 people, and 59% of them expressed interest in replacing their lawns. Most of them cited cost as the main barrier. Existing turf replacement programs do work, but they cover only about a quarter of the state's population. Laura Bellinger, a water resources engineer with Western Resource Advocates, told lawmakers during the February committee hearing. The statewide proposal, which would start with about $4 million, could expand those existing programs and help start new ones, Bellinger said. Representatives of the Colorado Water Conservation Board, the Colorado Cattlemen's Association, and the Colorado River District chimed in, supporting the measure. Plus, this type of conservation effort can help take pressure off the agriculture industry, Catlin said. The state's drought contingency plan, finalized in 2019, includes a program that pays farmers not to plant crops and instead send their water downstream. Similarly, the turf replacement program is another effective way to manage the state's growing demand for water, Catlin said. It wouldn't mandate the specific types of plants that could be used to replace more water-dependent lawns and instead leaves that decision to local programs. The committee unanimously approved the proposal, referring it to the House Appropriations Committee, where it is expected to be heard in the coming weeks. If the measure is enacted into law, the Colorado Water Conservation Board would have to develop a statewide turf replacement program by July 2023. Invasion of Ukraine. Planes, artillery, widen attack. Russia strikes cities far from the main battle lines, pressing its plan to bomb its neighbor into submission. By Yuris Karmanow, The Associated Press. Lviv, Ukraine. Russia's airplanes and artillery widened their assault on Ukraine on Friday, striking airfields in the west and a major industrial hub in the east, as Moscow's forces tried to regroup from recent losses and their onslaught fast reduced crowded cities to rubble. American defense officials offered an assessment of the Russian air campaign, estimating that invading pilots are averaging 200 sorties a day, compared with 5 to 10 for Ukrainian forces, which are focusing more on surface-to-air missiles, rocket-propelled grenades, and drones to take out Russian aircraft. New commercial satellite images appear to capture artillery firing on residential areas between Russian forces and the capital. The images from Maxar Technologies showed muzzle flashes and smoke from the big guns, as well as impact craters and burning homes in the town of Mushan outside Kiev, the company said. In a devastated village east of the capital, villagers climbed over toppled walls and flapping metal strips in the remnants of a pool hall, restaurant, and theater freshly blown apart by Russian bombs. Russian President Vladimir Putin created this mess thinking he will be in charge here, 62-year-old Ivan Mursik said. In temperatures sinking below freezing, villagers quickly spread plastic wrap or nailed plywood over blown-out windows of their homes. We are not going away from here, Mursik said. Russia's forces appear to be trying to regroup and regain momentum after encountering heavier losses and stiffer resistance than anticipated over the past 2 weeks. Britain's Ministry of Defense said Russia is trying to reset and reposture its troops, gearing up for operations against Kyiv. It's ugly already, but it's going to get worse, said Nick Reynolds, a warfare analyst at Royal United Services Institute, a British think tank. With the invasion in its 16th day, Putin said there had been certain positive developments in Russia-Ukraine talks, but he gave no details. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky claimed Ukrainian forces had reached a strategic turning point, although he did not elaborate. It's impossible to say how many days we will still need to free our land, but it is possible to say that we will do it, he said via video from Kyiv. Zelensky said authorities were working on establishing 12 humanitarian corridors and trying to ensure food, medicine, and other basics get to people across the country. Thousands of soldiers on both sides are believed to have been killed in the invasion, along with Ukrainian civilians. He accused Russia of kidnapping the mayor of one city, Melitopol, calling the abduction a new stage of terror. The Biden administration, citing American intelligence but no evidence, warned before the invasion of Russian plans to detain and kill targeted people in Ukraine. Zelensky himself would be a likely top target. So far, the Russians have made the biggest advances on cities in the east and south while struggling in the north and around Kyiv. Russia said it used high-precision, long-range weapons to put military airfields in Lutsk and Ivano-Frankivsk in the west out of action. The attack on Lutsk killed four Ukrainian servicemen, the mayor said. Russian airstrikes also targeted for the first time Dnipro, a major industrial hub in the east and Ukraine's fourth largest city with about 1 million people. One person was killed, Ukrainian officials said. In images of the aftermath released by Ukraine's emergency agency, firefighters doused a flaming building and ash fell on bloodied rubble. Smoke billowed over shattered concrete where buildings once stood. The bombardment continued in Mariupol, where a deadly strike on a maternity hospital this week sparked international outrage and allegations of war crimes. Unrelenting attacks have thwarted repeated attempts to send in food and medicine and evacuate citizens from Mariupol, a city of 430,000. In a statement, the Mariupol mayor's office said Friday that the toll of people killed during the 12-day siege had risen to 1,582. In the face of the unrelenting bombing, the dead aren't even being buried, the mayor's office said. About 400 apartment buildings in Kharkiv lost heat, and Mayor Ihor Terekhov appealed to remaining residents to descend into the subway or other underground shelters where blankets and hot food were being distributed. Charges dropped in 2020 killing. DA, victims' threatening actions fueled decision, by Elise Schmelzer, The Denver Post. Denver prosecutors decided to drop the murder charge they filed against an unlicensed security guard who fatally shot a man at a 2020 political rally, in part because of the victim's threatening actions immediately before the shooting. Denver District Attorney Beth McCann said in an interview Friday that her office did not believe it could prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the guard, Matthew Dolloff, wasn't reasonably acting in self-defense when he shot and killed Lee Keltner. The decision to drop the charge of second-degree murder was difficult, she said. The actions of the victim just before he was shot were very threatening, McCann said. His comments clearly indicated that his intention was to cause injury or worse, and it mattered what he had with him. Dolloff, 32, shot and killed Keltner, 49, on October 10, 2020, after Keltner yelled at the Nine News journalist whom Dolloff had been hired to protect while covering two opposing political rallies in Civic Center. One demonstration featured conservative Patriot Rally attendees. That group was met by left-leaning counter-protesters. Photos show Keltner slapped Dolloff in the face while holding a can of bear spray. Dolloff then drew a handgun he had concealed in his waistband, and Keltner raised his bear spray. Dolloff shot Keltner as Keltner sprayed the bear repellent at Dolloff. Prosecutors charged Dolloff with second-degree murder 5 days after the shooting, but decided Thursday they would drop the charge. The case was scheduled to go to trial next month. Dolloff was not licensed to work as a security guard in Denver, and members of management at Nine News have said they did not request an armed security guard or know that Dolloff was carrying a gun. Dolloff did have a valid concealed carry permit. McCann said Keltner's decision to slap Dolloff, his open possession of the bear spray, and a threatening comment Kessler made during the interaction complicated efforts to prove Dolloff wasn't acting in self-defense. It's a combination of all that and the people that were with him and their actions and what they were saying, she said. Keltner's family was blindsided by the district attorney's decision. His sister, Susan, said on the Stephen Tubbs Show radio program on KNUS AM on Thursday, "They explained to me that because my brother went and told them to get the camera out of his face and because my brother slapped him with an open hand, that Doloff had the right to feel fearful for his life," she said. Susan Keltner said her family believes the district attorney failed them. "Let a jury make that decision," she said. "Why are they folding over when there is video of him shooting him? It doesn't make sense." Under state law, a person can use deadly force in self-defense only if that person reasonably thinks using less force won't be sufficient, and the person reasonably believes that he or someone else faces an immediate threat of being killed or seriously hurt. There is no duty to retreat under state law, but the action taken in self-defense must be generally proportionate to the attack, experts have said. "It's the prosecution's burden to disprove a self-defense claim," McCann said. "Do I think Matthew Doloff should have been carrying a gun?" McCann said. "No, I don't think anybody at a rally should be carrying a gun, but they have a right to if they have a concealed weapon permit. I don't think this is a great resolution of that situation, but I have to look at the particular actions that happened right before and during the incident where Mr. Keltner was shot. I have to judge and apply the law to those facts. It doesn't mean that I think Doloff is a great guy or that he should have done what he did, but legally he's justified based on the evidence that we have." Most favored nation, U.S. EU G7 / Russian trade status, by Josh Boak, Chris Majerian, and Zeke Miller, The Associated Press. Washington. President Joe Biden announced Friday the U.S. will dramatically downgrade its trade status with Russia as punishment for its invasion of Ukraine and will ban imports of Russian seafood, alcohol, and diamonds. The broad trade shift, which revokes the most favored nation status for Russia, is being taken in coordination with the European Union and Group of Seven countries. "The free world is coming together to confront Putin," Biden said from the Roosevelt Room of the White House. He also said countries were adding new names to a list of Russian oligarchs who are facing sanctions, and the U.S. is cutting the flow of high-end American products, such as expensive watches, cars, and clothing. "We're banning the export of luxury goods to Russia," he said. Biden said there would be further retaliation if Ukraine is targeted with chemical weapons, a possibility that administration officials have warned about in recent days. Russia would pay a severe price if they used chemical weapons, he said. Stripping most favored nation status from Russia would allow the U.S. and allies to impose higher tariffs on some Russian imports, increasing the isolation of the Russian economy. Biden's changes on Russia's trade status come as bipartisan pressure has been building in Washington to revoke what is formerly known as permanent normal trade relations with Russia. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky pressed the U.S. and allies to take the action against Russia in remarks to Congress during the weekend. It follows days after Biden moved to ban imports of Russian oil and gas products. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Democrat of California, said lawmakers would pass legislation to formalize the trade downgrade. "Putin's premeditated, unprovoked war is an attack on the Ukrainian people and an attack on democracy, and the House remains steadfast in our commitment to partnering with President Biden and our allies to level swift, severe punishment and stand with the Ukrainian people," she said. This week's moves are the latest in a series of sanctions aimed at crippling the Russian economy and a sign that the U.S. and its allies will continue to use their financial heft to retaliate against Russian President Vladimir Putin. The other measures include the freezing of central bank assets, limits on exports, and sanctions against Russian oligarchs and their families. These financial tools have led to the Russian ruble losing about half of its value against the U.S. dollar over the past month, which has caused destructive inflation that could erode Putin's ability to wage a prolonged war in Ukraine. Most favored nation status has been a baseline for global trade, ensuring that countries within the World Trade Organization, or WTO, are treated similarly. Some countries in the WTO have special privileges because of their status as developing economies. Russia would join the ranks of Cuba and North Korea by not having most favored nation status from the U.S. The revocation carries mostly symbolic weight. The earlier sanctions on imports of Russian oil, gas, and coal already cut off about 60% of U.S. imports from the country, and the new import bans announced Friday add up to only about $1 billion in revenue, according to White House figures. Board considers appeal. Dugco judge ruled one-on-one meetings to discuss business must stop. By Jessica Seaman, The Denver Post. The deeply divided school board overseeing Douglas County School District spent Friday morning arguing whether to appeal a judge's preliminary injunction prohibiting directors from having one-on-one meetings to discuss district business privately. Ultimately, after more than an hour of discussion, the Board of Education decided to table the decision until its regular meeting, March 22nd. But the stakes of the decision to appeal the injunction and the overall case were made clear by School Board President Mike Peterson, who said he was concerned about the precedent being set. I think it is in the interest of not only this board, but multiple public boards to get clarification on what this ruling actually means from the judge, he said during the special meeting. But not every board member agreed, with Director Elizabeth Hansen saying it will cost tens of thousands of dollars to appeal a decision that says to follow the law. To appeal the decision, she said, the board's legal team would have to make the argument that we would actually like to have the ability to make decisions that are not in a public forum. Spending tax dollars to fight this is absurd, Hansen said. Under the state's open meeting law, if at least three school board members meet to discuss public business, then the public and other board members must be notified and the meeting made public. This includes if it is a meeting in person or by phone, email, or text. The crux of the lawsuit, filed by Highlands Ranch resident Robert Marshall, is whether the four majority members, Peterson, Christy Williams, Becky Myers, and Kaylee Winnegar, violated the state statute by holding a series of one-on-one meetings to make school board business decisions. Three of their colleagues, the minority on the board, have alleged the four violated the open meeting law in their efforts to replace former Superintendent Corey Wise. The case is potentially one of the first in the state that specifically addresses these types of serial one-on-one meetings, said Jeff Roberts, executive director of the Colorado Freedom of Information Coalition. In our view, it's been the case with the open meetings law. You cannot circumvent the quorum requirement in order to meet another way to collectively discuss a particular matter of public business and then come to a conclusion about it, he said. Otherwise, what is the point of having the open meetings law? On Wednesday, Douglas County District Judge Jeffrey Holmes ordered the school board to stop holding one-on-one meetings to discuss district business privately, saying that circumventing the statute by a series of private one-on-one meetings at which public business is discussed and/or decisions reached is a violation of the purpose of the statute, not just its spirit. On Friday, Williams, the vice president of the board, repeatedly pushed the board to move to executive or closed session to discuss an email with advice from attorneys with Hall and Evans before deciding whether to appeal the judge's order, but there wasn't enough support from the other directors to do so. Williams said she wanted to talk about the email and whether the prohibition of one-on-one meetings has always been the law. I don't believe that is how this board or previous boards have operated, despite what you're saying right now, Williams told Hansen. So that's why I wanted to go into executive session to ask questions around this, because quite honestly, if I had more clarity from the judge, I'd probably be fine to just move forward with where we are. Wise was fired without cause in a public meeting on February 4th after a 4-3 vote led by the four majority members. The injunction does not nullify that vote, as the overall case is still pending. The Douglas County School Board spent more than an hour discussing whether to appeal the injunction, despite a vote to take up such a resolution, failing early in the special meeting. Peterson, performance and leadership consultant, said he didn't think the preliminary injunction significantly would change how the school board operates, but he wants to move forward with an appeal because it could affect the overall lawsuit against the four members and board. We need to consider not just the narrow order issues, but the entire case when we look at this appeal, he said. Denver visit. Treasury Secretary says suspension of the federal gas tax is on the table. By Joe Rubino, The Denver Post. In Denver, to highlight the impacts of the Biden administration's COVID-19 relief bill, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen on Friday discussed the possibility that the administration might push for a temporary suspension of the federal gas tax. That's something Colorado's Democratic Governor Jared Polis has urged congressional leaders to consider in the wake of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. We're looking at a range of things that we might do to relieve consumers of the gas tax, Yellen said Friday at the Mi Casa Resource Center in West Denver. Yellen didn't commit to the idea fully. There are concerns within the administration that the move could benefit oil companies more than consumers at a time of tight supply. The supply strain can be attributed in part to President Joe Biden banning Russian oil imports amid the country's ongoing military offensive in Ukraine. Polis stood next to Yellen on Friday. The governor, Second Gentleman Doug Emhoff, and a handful of Denver officials appeared at the Resource Center to discuss the American Rescue Plan Act, the piece of the legislation that the Biden administration pushed last March to fuel the country's economic recovery from the COVID-19 recession. Mi Casa received $325,000 in support through that legislation granted by the city of Denver. The economy is growing, and the federal unemployment rate fell to 3.8% in February. But Yellen acknowledged that inflation is a problem. Efforts by the Federal Reserve to combat that through higher interest rates could trigger a recession, but Yellen has faith the Fed can steer clear of that outcome, she said. Polis was asked Friday what he would like to see federal officials do to ease price burdens on Coloradans, and he mentioned a federal gas tax holiday he and five other governors are supporting. The group is backing legislation that would suspend the federal gas tax through the end of the year. The 18.3 cents per gallon tax supports the Federal Highway Trust Fund. Gas prices are spiking across the country, including in Colorado, where the average price hit $3.97 a gallon on Friday, according to AAA. That's the highest fuel price in the state since June 2013. AAA projects that Colorado is on a path to eclipse its all-time record for gas prices of $4.09 per gallon, which was set in 2008. Polis is moving to delay a 2 cents per gallon gas fee that was supposed to take effect in Colorado this year, part of his efforts to reduce costs for state residents in a variety of ways. We're really looking at everything we can do as a state to reduce costs, and I certainly encourage the federal government to do the same to alleviate some of that pressure that people are feeling because of increasing costs, he said Friday. Yellen emphasized that spiking gas prices largely can be attributed to the Russia-Ukraine war and the economic ripple effects of international sanctions against Russia. The worst impacts are on Russia itself, which is our intention, but there are spillovers to the United States and to the other countries, Yellen said. That's unavoidable, and I think the American people understand the importance of suffering some toll themselves in order to uphold the values that we hold dear and we think are fundamental to a peaceful world order. Light rail trains. RTD bows to riders on a third car. By John Murray, The Denver Post. Light rail trains on four regional transportation district lines will resume running with three car sets on weekdays after riders protested a decision to shorten them to two cars this week. A spokeswoman for RTD said the decision to run smaller train sets on the D, E, W, and H lines, which took effect Monday, was based on low average ridership per train, well below the longer train's capacity. But the continuing pandemic has changed some riders' perceptions of how full trains should be, complicating decisions for RTD. That's especially so on commuter-heavy routes such as RTD's light rail lines, which have recovered more slowly on average than bus routes. The recent Omicron wave of COVID-19 cases set back some of those gains. We took a careful look at the number of customers riding per train. In so doing, we discovered that throughout the day, the average number of individuals was 13 per train, not per car, per train. RTD spokeswoman Lori Huff wrote in an email, "To reduce power consumption, maintenance costs, and wear and tear on equipment, we reduced the train set size to match our ridership numbers. Some riders lodged complaints, citing health and other concerns, especially when more riders than average were on board. RTD has reversed the decision to run shorter trains," she said, "and three car sets will return beginning Monday. We respect the comments and concerns that customers have voiced about this decision, and we want to be responsive to them," Huff said. Face masks are still required aboard public transit vehicles. On Thursday, federal authorities extended the requirement by a month through April 18th. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said it would work with other agencies during that time on a revised policy that could offer more flexibility based on COVID-19 levels in a transit provider's community and other factors. 2020 George Floyd protest. Man shot in face with pepper ball files lawsuit, by Kieran Nicholson, The Denver Post. A man who was shot in the face by a Denver police officer during the George Floyd protests filed a federal lawsuit Thursday, claiming that excessive force used by police violated his constitutional rights of freedom of speech and assembly. Daryl Hampton claims that on May 30, 2020, Denver police officer John Allred purposely shot him in the face with a pepper ball as Hampton used a smartphone to take images of armed police suited up in riot gear. About 5:30 p.m., Hampton was near the intersection of 14th Avenue and Lincoln Street near the Colorado Capitol when he was shot. While speaking out against police brutality, Mr. Hampton, a black man, became a victim of the same police brutality he was protesting, the 55-page complaint said. He was exercising his First Amendment rights on that sidewalk through his participation in the ongoing protest against police brutality. The lawsuit claims that Denver police used excessive force to violate Mr. Hampton's constitutional rights. The lawsuits name several people who were shot by police with pepper balls and rubber bullets, documenting the time and place of the incidents along with photos of the injured. Denver has repeatedly condoned its officers' egregious excessive force throughout the George Floyd protests, said attorney Andy McNulty, who represents Hampton, in a statement. It has sent the message to its officers that what happened to Mr. Hampton and others like him was A-OK. Until someone is held accountable, Denver officers will continue to violate the Constitution. The pepper ball fired by Allred hit Hampton in the face and exploded, the complaint said. Hampton fell to the ground and was disoriented. He was helped to his feet by demonstrators, one who poured milk on his face to calm the irritation. Hampton's face burned for hours, and the shot caused bruising, physical pain, and suffering. The pepper ball destroyed Hampton's phone. The incident was documented by a witness, and that documentation is part of the filing. Denver's police customs, policies, practices, training, and supervision caused the violation of Mr. Hampton's constitutional rights, the claim said. The lawsuit claims excessive force and due process violations. The filing seeks a trial along with economic and compensatory claims in an amount to be determined at trial, among other remedies. Green Valley Ranch. HOA filed 50 foreclosures. Fines, fees levied against homeowners driving the actions. City plans meeting to help the community, by Kieran Nicholson, The Denver Post. The number of potential home foreclosures brought by a homeowners association, or HOA, on the south side of Denver's Green Valley Ranch area was so disconcerting to city officials that they are holding a community meeting Saturday offering resources for homeowners. Fines and fees levied by the Master Homeowners Association for Green Valley Ranch, MHAGVR, and homeowners who have failed to comply with the HOA's notices are driving the foreclosure threat, with 68 homeowners affected since January 2021, according to city officials. In 2021, the number of HOA foreclosure notices filed throughout all of Denver was 119, said Britta Fisher, executive director of the city's Department of Housing Stability. The Green Valley Association filed 50 of the 119 HOA notices last year. It's a large percentage of the foreclosures filed in 1 year by one HOA, she said. 50 were filed by one HOA? That tends to stand out. The Denver Department of Housing Stability, Denver Office of Financial Empowerment and Protection, and the nonprofit Denver Metro Fair Housing Center are among organizers who will be at Saturday's meeting. We are trying to help. We want to be available and be there, said City Council President Stacy Gilmore of District 11, who represents the area. Gilmore received an email February 8th from a constituent who faced a foreclosure notice and asked for assistance. Within about a week, Gilmore became aware of 10 other area homeowners who were also in peril of foreclosure. It's mostly from HOA covenants on homes, Gilmore said. Requirements like you can't paint your home a certain color, or you can't leave a trash can in the street, or you didn't take down a basketball hoop in the driveway. If homeowners failed to comply, they most likely get a warning. And if it's not taken care of, fines are levied. When homeowners fail to act, fines compound with late fees and interest and sometimes attorney's fees. Some of the people facing HOA foreclosures in the Green Valley Ranch area are part of the city's affordable housing portfolio, Gilmore said. We are monitoring it and trying to figure out how deep this is, Gilmore said. We're still in an information gathering phase, but we are trying to shore this up. We are trying to make sure that people can hold on to their housing and get the resources they need. The Green Valley Association's Board of Directors released a statement Friday morning. The Homeowners Association of Green Valley Ranch creates curb appeal and increases property values by enforcing promises that the homeowners made to one another about the condition and upkeep of their properties. The Colorado Common Interest Ownership Act authorizes the HOA to enforce fines and makes those fines an automatic lien on property. Enforcement is not a surprise. All owners are provided written notice of any violation and an opportunity to cure that violation. Prior to any fine, a second notice is mailed informing the owner that they can have a hearing with the board to explain any extenuating circumstances. If the association and owner cannot resolve the violation, a fine is levied, and that fine is a lien that may eventually be subject to collection and/or foreclosure. It is only after repeated notices and non-payment that legal intervention may be required. During the pandemic, bank foreclosures were stayed, but HOA foreclosures were not. Despite the legal right to do so, the Homeowners Association of Green Valley Ranch voluntarily suspended its collection and foreclosure of liens out of concern for housing during the pandemic. The reported increase in foreclosures is nothing more than resumption of normal actions, which were halted in 2020, along with more recent enforcement actions. The board has always and continues to remain open to resolution of these cases in an amicable manner. Abortion. Texas Clinic's lawsuit on ban effectively over, by Paul J. Weber and Jamie Stengel, The Associated Press. Austin, Texas. The state Supreme Court on Friday dealt essentially a final blow to abortion clinics' best hopes of stopping a restrictive law that has sharply curtailed the number of abortions in the state since September and will now fully stay in place for the foreseeable future. The ruling by the all-Republican court was not unexpected, but it slammed the door on what little path forward the U.S. Supreme Court had allowed Texas clinics after having twice declined to stop a ban on abortions after about 6 weeks of pregnancy. It spells the coming end to a federal lawsuit that abortion clinics filed even before the restrictions took effect in September. There is nothing left. This case is effectively over with respect to our challenge to the abortion ban, said Mark Herron, attorney for the Center for Reproductive Rights. Although Texas abortion clinics are not dropping the lawsuit, they now expect it will be dismissed in the coming weeks or months. The Texas law bans abortion after about 6 weeks of pregnancy and makes no exceptions in cases of rape or incest. In December, the U.S. Supreme Court decided to keep the law in place and allowed a narrow challenge against the restrictions to proceed. The decision by the Texas Supreme Court turned on whether medical licensing officials had an enforcement role under the law and therefore could be sued by clinics. The Texas court said no. Land management. U.S. plans to increase cooperation with tribes. By Susan Montoya Bryan, The Associated Press. Albuquerque. National Park Service Director Chuck Sams said Tuesday he and other officials are committed to boosting the role Native American tribes can play in managing public lands around the U.S. He told members of a congressional committee during a virtual hearing that part of the effort includes integrating indigenous knowledge into management plans and recognizing that federal lands once belonged to the tribes. Sams was questioned about how the National Park Service could use existing authority and recent executive directives issued by top federal officials to make good on the latest round of promises to tribes regarding meaningful consultation and having a seat at the table. Sams, who is Cayuse and Walla Walla and a citizen of the Confederate Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation, is the first Native American to lead the Park Service. He said education will be a key part of seeing changes on the ground. Much of this has been missing from our history books, that understanding that tribes are sovereign, he said, adding that the federal government has an obligation to ensure that tribal voices are heard. There are four national parks where tribes share co-management responsibilities. Canyon de Chelly National Monument within the boundaries of the Navajo Nation in Arizona, Glacier Bay National Park and Preserve in southeast Alaska, Grand Portage National Monument within the Grand Portage Indian Reservation in Minnesota, and Big Cypress National Preserve in Florida. Tribal officials from New Mexico, Colorado, and the Pacific Northwest also testified about the importance of including Native American voices when weighing decisions that could affect cultural sites, water supplies, or forest health. Sams said his agency has about 80 cooperative agreements in place with tribes now, and he expects that number to grow. At Acadia National Park, the Wabanaki Nations of Maine have been involved in a multi-year project focused on traditional gathering of sweetgrass that has resulted from centuries of learned ecological knowledge. The Nisqually tribe is working with officials at Mount Rainier National Park to publish a report on plant gathering there. Consultation with the tribe also has resulted in a guide for developing interpretive programs. Carlton Bowataki, the lieutenant governor of Zuni Pueblo and a member of the Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition, told lawmakers that tribes in the southwestern U.S. banded together to protect their mutual interests as part of the fight over the Bears Ears National Monument in Utah. Although some tribal communities are hundreds of miles away from the monument, Bowataki said the area still plays an integral role in traditional practices and ceremonies, and that tribes are being asked for their traditional knowledge as the Bureau of Land Management and the U.S. Forest Service work on a management plan for the monument. What could be a better avenue of restorative justice than giving tribes the opportunity to participate in the management of lands that their ancestors were removed from, he asked, adding that collaborative problem-solving and a candid exchange of perspectives will be crucial for co-management to work. Doug Kyle, a citizen of the Oneida Nation and an assistant professor of history at Northwestern University, told the congressional panel about a philosophy of long-term planning that is central to many Native American tribes. He said it centers on what will be in the best interest of people seven generations from now. Land managers today can learn from thousands of years of history, he said, as the pressures of climate change and global instability mount. One important way to think about what it means to incorporate indigenous thought into these dialogues is to think about depth of time, a different perspective, he said. That's a lot of what we're talking about with traditional ecological knowledge. Western wildfires, dwindling snowfall impedes firefighting, by Brittany Peterson and Matthew Brown, The Associated Press. Deckers. Dripping flaming fuel, a line of workers slowly descends a steep, snow-covered hillside above central Colorado's South Platte River, torching piles of woody debris that erupt into flame, shooting two stories high. It's winter in the Rocky Mountains, and fresh snow cover allowed the crew of 11 to confine the controlled burns safely. Such operations are a central piece of the Biden administration's $50 billion plan to reduce the density of western forests that have been exploding into firestorms as climate change bakes the region. But the same warming trends that worsen wildfires also challenge the administration's attempts to guard against them. Increasingly erratic weather means snow is not always there when needed to safely burn off tall debris piles such as those on Colorado's Pike San Isabel National Forest, and that seriously complicates the job of exhausted firefighters now forced into service year-round. Their goal is to cut and burn enough vegetation that the next fires won't be as catastrophic as ones that leveled vast forest land and neighborhoods in Colorado, California, Oregon, Montana, and elsewhere. Western wildfires have become more volatile as climate change dries forests thick with vegetation from years of intensive fire suppression, and the window for controlled burns is shrinking. It's been a little harder just because of shorter winters, said David Needham, a U.S. Forest Service ranger who led the Colorado burn operation in late February when the thermometer hovered around 0 degrees Fahrenheit. Surrounding hillsides showed barren scars from past wildfires, including a 2002 blaze that destroyed 133 homes and at the time was the largest in state history. On days like this, we capitalize on temperature being in the negatives, Needham said. Even small snowstorms coming indefinitely helps us with that. Across the Rockies, piles of slash and trees clear to reduce fire hazards span some 100,000 acres, waiting to be burned once the right amount of snow is on the ground. Sometimes there's too much, making the piles inaccessible. Other times, there's not enough snow, and prescribed burns get canceled so they don't get out of hand, as did a previous one that led to fatalities. An overnight snow in central Denver meant the crew from the Forest Service and Mile High Youth Corps could burn debris from twice the area they planned. Yet officials said climate change is making it more difficult to find that sweet spot for safe burning. Spring is arriving earlier, and snow-covered ground is disappearing 2 weeks sooner, according to Rutgers University researcher and New Jersey state climatologist David Robinson, who has examined more than 50 years of snow cover data collected through satellite imagery. One thing we know about climate change is it is increasing the variability and the extremes we are experiencing, said Robinson. Out west, once the season shifts, you get very dry very quickly, and it stays dry for months. So you have a real tight window there. 2020 was the worst wildfire season on record in Colorado, where summers and falls also have been warmer and drier, said Assistant State Climatologist Becky Bollinger. It's a completely different ballgame in terms of wildfires, she said. For parts of the Rockies, this winter brought too much snow, forcing officials to delay burns. Meanwhile, parts of Wyoming haven't received enough snow to moisten the ground and allow fuel piles to be torched. Even when there is snow, that doesn't mean it will last until the debris stops smoldering, said Brian Keating with the Forest Service's Rocky Mountain region. When pile burns turn into wildfires, Keating said it's usually because snow around when the burn started disappears. The next windstorm can kick up embers and ignite landscape that days earlier seemed fireproof. Putting off pile burning carries consequences, too. Until the piles are gone, forest managers won't begin another kind of controlled fire called broadcast burning, which consumes vegetation within stands previously thinned with chainsaws and other equipment. If we don't burn the piles, that can get kicked down the road another year or two, said Keating. And every year, we keep building this backlog of piles because we can't get to them all. Another problem is smoke. Burns can be delayed if the smoke will exacerbate poor air quality. Despite such hurdles, burns are critical to the Biden administration's 10-year plan to reduce wildfire hazards across almost 80,000 square miles of public, private, and tribal lands. The recently passed infrastructure bill includes $500 million for controlled burns over 5 years. Prescribed burns and logging were used to reduce wildfire hazards last year on about 4,050 square miles of forest, the most in a decade. By ramping that up, officials hope to get ahead of the problem and use less logging in future years, said Frankie Romero, who oversees the Forest Service's prescribed burn program. Once we get into a maintenance cycle and we can continue to treat that same area while it's in its preferred condition with a lot less fuel, then it becomes a lot easier, Romero said. We're going to experience wildfires in the future, and they're going to cause problems. The difficult part is trying to remember what those problems would have looked like had we not intervened earlier. Oregon State University forestry professor John Bailey said the choice is between unchecked wildfires raging across the landscape and aggressive steps to at least partially counteract the forces of climate change. Not to embrace this challenge is choosing a future with a lot of wildfire in it and almost no control over where they start and where they spread and how much smoke is in the air and for how long. Please remember that daylight savings time begins tomorrow, Sunday, March 13th. Be sure to turn your clocks ahead 1 hour this evening. Thank you for joining us for the Saturday, March 12th, 2022 reading of the Denver Post. My name is Doug Crane.